CliffCentral.com.
Yeah, good morning, everybody. What's happening? It's live. It's Wednesday. Yeah, that means Gord is here. It means C is here. It means you are here and I'm here. And there are many, many others who we will... They don't want to be... they don't want to muscle in on our actions, so they've asked to be anonymous. Isn't that nice?
Very nice. The only way I know what day of the week it is...
Is because like,
time has become meaningless and days of the week have become meaningless under lockdown. There's just 2 days where statistically you're slightly less likely to have a video meeting. And I kind of get a message from Sia, God, are you awake? And like, always at about 20 minutes before, always 20 minutes before I'm actually going to wake up. And I see that and I'm like, oh, it must be Wednesday already?
Yeah. Sia's very, he's very nice about this, you know. I used to be woken up by Damon, not by Sia. Back in the old
Damon.
Days. Damon would phone.
Who woke you up at Nightmon?
The Rastafarians especially found that funny. So
bless them.
I used to get a call from him at, what was it, 4:45 every morning, right?
But that was when you still had the commute.
Yeah, and he would phone me, and my phone would ring, and it was always on loud. And they would go off on my bedside table and go, oh, Jesus, it's 4:45. What kind of a time is this to be awake?
Hello, Gareth. It's me, Damon. Are you awake?
So because always, you don't have caller ID as well.
Well, somehow. I always found it funny that he had to explain to me that it's me, Damon, every day, regardless. Mm. And are you awake? Well, I picked up my phone. What do you think?
You've always got to admire the people or feel sorry for the people who wake up the people who get up early. Like, what's he doing so bright and chipper that he can yell at you with a loud hailer?
Absolutely. What a job. I mean, no wonder he wanted to stop eventually.
I have to note, it is because I would get the best wake-up calls as a child.
Oh, yeah?
And growing up. Oh, my helper actually deserves like a freaking award for this. When I was still probably in primary school, she would wake me up at least like 20 minutes before I have to. And she'd walk in and open the curtains a little. I mean, who the does something like that?
You got woken up like the queen. You got woken up like the queen of England. You know what you happens to her? There's a routine that they do for the Queen every day. I don't know whether this is 100% true or not, because who the hell's been in the Queen's bedroom? Apparently what happens is...
Or the Requeen, as they call it.
The what?
The Requeen. Good morning.
So what happens is the person who works in the palace, whoever is, it's her handmaid or whoever.
The ladies in waiting.
The ladies in waiting just follow her around. They're basically there. They don't actually have much of a job anymore. They used to have jobs.
They're a squad, professional squad.
They come in and they do exactly what your helper used to do. They open the curtain so that the sun shines in, and then they put down a little breakfast tray with some toast and some tea. And then they ring a little, tiny little bell. It goes like this.
All of that, as much as that's all ceremonial and nice, it's still just being hit over the head with sunshine and a painful bell noise every morning.
No, God, it's still not the same.
Death and waking up are the great equalizers.
I don't think waking up, Gord and I have the same attitude to waking up. It's never a pleasant experience because I love sleep so much that I could just carry on.
I have to pry my eyelids open. Mm. Sometimes I have to weld them open but the worst for me is sunlight. Like Blackie Chan digs to climb in and out of the bedroom window only when it's not convenient for me and never when it suits me. And when she does so, she pushes my curtains open a little bit. So some mornings they're like open a few inches and like when you realize that the sun is blinding your retinas and you have to get up and walk 3 steps and close the curtain, it's the worst.
I think you're oddly a vampire then.
Yeah, I know people who have those blackout curtains that they use in
I've got
hotels.
Those. Blackie Chan says no.
Those things, you could stop the power of the sun. Just think of how powerful they are. Those curtains can stop the power of the sun. It's incredible.
Yeah, curtains versus the sun.
You
Round
could be in
one fight.
Perpetual night if you decide to be. But I think that part of the reason that Gordon and I don't like waking up is because we're more like night owls. I'm much happier when, you know, I'm working late at night. I did last night. I was sitting doing some work for Blind History, which is, I can't wait for this next season to start. It's, I think you're going to love it. Anyway, I was sitting and doing some work until probably about 12:30, which I love. I try to get to sleep early, but most nights it doesn't happen. I'll end up reading.
Yeah, me too.
Or whatever.
I find if I try to go to bed too early, I just lie in bed for hours.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think...
But this is life. We're up. We do it for the love of the radio.
We do, and we have shit to do. I mean, like that. Mm-hmm. How lucky are we? Because there are people who don't have anything to wake up for this morning because they don't have work or, you know, there's no one who is bothering to call them and wake them up because... No one gives a shit. So let's be grateful for the little things.
Thanks for giving a shit, listeners.
Yeah,
thanks. My morning meditation today was reframing your day and starting with I get to as opposed to I have to.
So interesting.
Yes.
It's so interesting that you bring that up because we do all feel sorry for ourselves when we don't have exactly what we want. And and one of the things that you can pick up, and I've heard this from a number of philosophers, is that you find meaning and purpose in your life by having responsibilities, not by avoiding them. And therefore, if you actually wake up in the morning and you've got shit to do, you're the lucky one. You have meaning and purpose in your life. And I know that sounds so easy for people to say when they're unhappy and, you know, and they don't want to hear you. But really, that's the thing. I mean, like, if I didn't have this show to wake up for in the morning, who knows? I might wake up at different times every day, and I might not have a routine, and I might not be as together as I sometimes think I am. I mean, occasionally that doesn't come true, but you know how it goes. I've been reading, and it's partly for the first episode of this new season of Blind History, but I found myself going down a wormhole again. Because I started off with this book on the history of Jerusalem, which I've spoken about before, so I won't bore you with that. But it's about the Temple of Solomon. I mean, you want to get into some serious arcane knowledge, just read this, because this is the kind of thing that the Bible is at great pains to talk about and talks about in enormous detail. And I don't know if anybody who's listening to us now cares about this stuff at all, so I'm not gonna you know, go too deep into it this morning, but my God, I mean, there are books and books and books and books that have been written about this. It is part of the central idea of like Freemasonry, the idea of David and Solomon, and you know, how David wasn't pure enough to build the temple, and then Solomon was, and how the temple actually housed the presence of God on earth, and what was in there and how big it was. I mean, they measure it out. You know what a cubit is, by the way? It's the unit of measurement in the Bible. A cubit is the distance from your elbow to your outstretched middle finger. And it's pretty much consistent for most people.
Yeah, but this is the point at which I stop taking things seriously. It's like, right, we've got the book of all universal truth from which all action shall be based. It is the absolute and finite truth. Now, let's get to measuring things. Everyone, use your forearm. Okay, guys, this is when you guys reach the space travel phase of this thing that you're starting off with.
No.
Your elbow, your qubit system's gonna fuck out.
No, of course it will. But
it's all right for those hay houses that we're planning. But when we get to spaceships, we got to find something better than a qubit.
Well, they were very particular about this temple, man. They were massively into getting it right because it mattered. It was not just any house, it was the house of God. So with the amount of precision and interest and care that we take with a spacecraft today, they would have treated this. And remember, it took them, 40 years or something to build the temple, the first one, because there were three. There were two proper temples, and there was one in between that was kind of, what was his name, Zebediah or something. Built the middle one, but the original Temple of Solomon, I mean, they talk about what kind of wood was used to construct it and how much gold was used to construct it and precisely what furniture went into it. I mean, it really was like a labor of intense zealotry to put this thing together.
Labor of religion. But I mean, all of the cathedrals all over Europe that took 100 or 200 years to build, and they're like so extravagant, and those also are a very similar thing. It's like we're going to take as much resources as we can, build something as extra as we can, and we won't even live to see it finished. Oh, and by the way, we'll put statues of 40 dudes on the front of it, and at the bottom, a woman, because that's the Mother Mary, mm-hmm. and Jesus will be just one of the 40 dudes we make statues of in our God palace.
Well, I mean, what an incredible thing to imagine that you start working on something. Let's say you're a stonemason. And you start building a cathedral at Reims or at Chartres or in Paris or in Cologne. Or
I think about what that would be like all the time, yeah.
Yeah, I do, because you start building something and you're never going to see it finished, because it's only going to be finished in 125 years and you're already 30 and you've started hammering at a piece of stone. And maybe you put 500 stones into the building and you've carved 10 of the statues, but there are 50 other guys who are doing exactly the same amount of work as you. And even though you're all working simultaneously, there's not going to be enough time for all of you to be able to complete your work and see everything done. Like, we are the heirs of those people's labors in some ways.
When it's all finished, also, you're not going to be remembered much, but the dudes that you sculpted, who are like the board of directors of the church, they're going to be immortalized forever.
Yeah.
But also, we'll put Jesus on there.
Well, it wasn't about them, and not even the architects in most of these cathedrals were remembered. It was all for the glory of something greater than them. Amazing. I mean,
yeah, but my problem is that
talk about delayed gratification. I mean, we can't even if our McDonald's burger takes more than 5 minutes to get ready, then we're like, oh, this is such a slow McDonald's. I can't believe it.
What's the Gaudi building that I can't remember the name of that fills me with such resentment in Barcelona?
Sacra, what's it called?
That's driving me insane because I've been there like four times.
Yes, it's in Barcelona. God, no, this is so embarrassing because as someone who cares about architecture, I really should know this.
And also,
Sagrada Familia.
Sagrada Familia. Yeah, that thing, it was it's probably about two-thirds finished now, and it's not going to be done for decades, because also, not only do they have to finish it according to Gaudi's exact plans, they've got to use the similar methods.
I
think part of it is you didn't even think that far to, completion, and, one day it will be great, when everyone around you was dying at, 28.
Yeah, but it's absolutely incredible that human endeavor would bring these people together, and they would do this as a labor of love and a labor of devotion, and then they would never see it finished, but they were happy to do that. It's sort of that old parable of the man who plants a forest for his great-great-grandchildren. And, in parts of Europe, for example, people do inherit a forest, which was planted by their great-great-great-great-grandfather. And then they get to chop the wood. Now, the person who plants that forest, that is an incredible amount of investment in the future. And for many of us, it's difficult to understand that, because we think only in terms of investing in things during our lifetime. Just by the way, Imabulaleyo, if you could just restart the phone on that side that gets our messages, because I'm for some reason not getting them.
I'm going to ring my bell.
Yeah,
good. I think to an extent I just wanted to
explain why I'm not responding to messages if anybody's sending them. We'll get that sorted out.
I think in the day, though, also, like, if you were an artist, because there's also a beautiful classic painting that I can't remember now that I saw in Spain, where it was commissioned by the church, and it's this massive thing of the resurrection, but the artist put all of his friends and family in the painting, just because he had to use faces of someone. So I think also, like, the church were the big clients then. If you were an artist, it's like working for a big satanic brand now, if you're stuck in advertising. Like, you get to do creative work, and you get to do creative work, and they've got budget, and no one else has budget. So if you want to do a big, like, elaborate digital VR or AR experience, or a 5 million rand ad campaign shot by Michael Bay, you have to stab yourself in the creative nuts and do it for Coca-Cola.
Right.
They're probably just a random example. No, well, no lawsuits here, please.
Well, yeah.
But the church would say,
like, language.
If you want to make a massive statue, the only people who can pay you to do it are the church. And they'll be like, right, sneak Jesus in at the bottom, and we want these 40 guys who are in charge of the church, put statues of them on it, and cool, you've got 200 years. He has money. You're like, well, I got to sculpt something. It might as well be these guys and yeah. Jesus.
Gord, you're coming at this from a very depressing and pessimistic angle. I'm trying to say that there's something existentially amazing about people who are willing to devote time and energy to this. You're like, it's just about who's paying and who's the statue of, and you grumpy old
look,
fuck.
I'm going to be forgotten 5 minutes after my death, and the cubit will be remembered forever. So who am I to criticize?
Well, in some way, yes, in some ways, no, because these recordings may last forever, as far as we know. We've got means of keeping them now, which they didn't.
Which is why I watch what I say now that I'm starting a children's book company.
Oh, listen, we'll talk about that later, because I want to give it the full attention it deserves once the book is ready to go. I don't want to talk too much about it.
No, I'm just saying I'm worried about the cancellation potential of that.
Yeah,
with this.
Gord and I have been talking because he's I'm so lucky. He's been sharing his stories with me, and I've actually read them all more than once.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, you've sent me four, I think, and then you read me one last night. Jesus, Jim.
Yeah,
I mean,
these are going to.
I am just absolutely. You know, when you come face to face with a talent, and I mean, I've always known Gord was funny and clever, so I've always enjoyed talking to him. No, sure. I mean, you know,
I appreciate it. I'm getting bashful, so I have to do that every now and again.
Take the compliment, but this is Gord. This, if you get this thing done the way that I foresee it's going to be done, and you've poured your heart and soul into this, it's just absolutely amazing, and I cannot wait, because it would be your magnum opus. It's just
I always appreciate that that you tell it like it is. Gareth's not afraid to give his real opinion.
There are going to be so many happy kids if you publish this book.
Well, dude, I appreciate it, because I know you would say so if you thought something about it was off. So it's been fun, but like I said, we'll talk about it when there's something tangible to talk about. But the support's been amazing. What I do though, going back to your previous point though, is I feel like I've got something to finish, and then I put it off until the afternoon because I'm just not into it. And then I work, and then once I'm started, I don't want to stop, and I work till like midnight or 1 or 2, and that's when I have a rough morning the next morning. Like, I get so stuck into it that I forget what the time is.
Yeah.
If only you could engage that mode at a time that suits.
That's what you know. That's the key to doing something that you're absolutely brilliant at and that you love and that you don't consider work, because your time just runs away. So what did you want to say, Sia?
Now, pardon me. I'm still stuck on the fact that Gord read his book to you. Wait, did he just call you and say, hey, Gareth, do you have 8 minutes?
We arranged it. Like, we made a time.
That's so sweet.
Yeah, he called me last night. But it's just one of those things also that, you know, normally when someone says to me, can I read you my poem? You run a mile.
Because we always get, can you listen to my song?
I was careful about that, the fishes. I'm like, Gareth, look, I'm just going to mail you this. If you've got some time to check it out, cool. If you don't, it's fine. Then Gareth's like, this is great. Send me the next one. I'm like, cool, man. I'll send it to you soon. And then I send the next one. Gareth's like, send me all of them. So I was like encouraged by your enthusiasm. I wasn't trying to dumb. There's something about that. Like,
I hope you don't mind, but I read one of them to my mom.
I'm happy that people are testing them on their family and friends.
Absolutely loved it. So I'm careful who I'm sharing it with until you've got it published, but I do love it. Anyway, you know, normally when someone presents you with their work, you're like, oh, God.
But just to slightly seg away from that, it goes to the thing of, like, these stories rhyme. So in my mind, they come from the same place as poems. I've always had this thing, like, there's nothing wankier. Yeah, exactly. But I don't mind giving someone something of mine and saying, hey, what do you think of this, and getting some critique. But when it's poetry, it feels like the most self-indulgent and wanky thing ever to, like, ask people to read it and be like, so, what did you think? So, like, I'm always a little bit hesitant with these to be like, look, read it if you want to. I'm sharing it with a couple of people that I know will give me honest feedback, and it's very encouraging. But, yeah, man, good times. Thanks, GC.
They say, just to bring this whole art discussion, because that's what it is, it's works of, and this will hopefully, you know, live longer than Gord, these stories he's written, and those buildings, some of them survive to this day. Architecture is regarded as the highest art of all. They used to teach architecture once you learnt the other arts. So for Michelangelo...
Sorry, whose hardy does are those?
They're my hardy does.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Nice, Gareth. Good hardy does. Yeah.
Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci, and for them, the apogee of their careers was when they got to devote themselves to building structures, not just to sculpting or to painting or to frescoes or any of those things. You know, those were, and drawings and innovations were part of it, but to build things that humans could move around in was considered
still to this day
closest to godliness. I've always had a huge respect for architects. My aunt is an architect. I go to sleep at night and I dream of spaces, in terms of like rooms and buildings and that's, I dream in that kind of 3D.
Do any of them have smorgasbords in them? Because I have the same dream.
No smorgasbords. But really, like architecture is—it's just so fascinating to me, and it's such an important part of human history. Because if we can imagine the places people dwelt and moved around in, we get to know a little bit about those people, right?
Yeah. Also, like cathedrals, the Catholic cathedrals. So, like, if you look at the ones sort of in the UK, and you look at the ones more towards Eastern Europe and Spain and that, and they all built along very similar – they all built basically with the same shell. But the UK ones –
most of them are in the shape of a cross, and they mostly face the east – the west is where the doors are, and the east the eastern end, which faces towards Jerusalem, is where the kind of – the altar and all of those things are. Yeah.
And it always matches the proportions of Puff the Magic Dragon's body, which is amazing. But they all look kind of like they're built from the same kit, but the UK ones have been plonked down and coal has been burnt near them for centuries. Yeah. And the Spanish ones and the East European ones have been polished every day for 1,000 years with new rubies placed in every time an old one starts to get dull. So you've got the same thing left to become gothic and scary and Adams Family-ish, and the same thing kept in all of its glory, and they're equally like terrifying and imposing. One is like the dark god of soot and rain, and the other one is the fabulous god of RuPaul, and they have similar cathedrals, but they decorate them differently.
So look, not that both of you are, you know, so presumptuous and you have your nose stuck up in the air, but the fact that you have this appreciation for art and architecture and whatnot, when you are driving around in the East Rond, for example, and you see Monte de Tetra, something that
you're heading up the N1 towards Krasmir and you check the ocean.
Does it piss you off?
But this is
think to myself, like,
you know, people who go to a clinker brick Engiekerk church with an ugly steeple. That's I'm sure for them that building is very important because it's a place of community and all of that stuff. But architecturally, it's revolting. I was having this conversation with Spike and Dory yesterday because we had a meeting at the office and we're busy planning a series on architecture, which one of South Africa's most I think he's easily one of the most prestigious architects in the country is very keen to get going. And it's come about as an offshoot of Blind History, which he listened to. And now he wants to do a series on architecture and design, which I think a lot of us would be fascinated with, especially to hear it from a great architect. Anyway, we were talking about this yesterday, and Spike was saying that there is some modern architecture he really likes. And I can't say I hate all modern architecture because, for example, I love New York with its skyscrapers. And there are some modern buildings which are absolutely breathtaking. But by and large, I'm of Prince Charles's mold that I see most architecture post the neoclassical as being just revolting to look at. He called a particular building in London a monstrous carbuncle on the city's general appearance or something like that. I feel like that about most things that are not according to, you know, Palladian or neoclassical design principles.
I hate it when it's not Palladian. Now, I just find like the more cutting edge modern a thing looks when it's being built, the worse it will age.
That's the point. It's also the same goes for the way that your house looks on the inside. If you make it as classical as possible, it just doesn't date as badly. If you're going with, let's say you decorate your whole house in Art Deco and it's the 1930s and you think, wow, this is the absolute apex of cool. And within like 30 years, everyone's going, Jesus, your house looks like your grand's.
Like in the 80s and 90s, if you had money and you wanted to build something ultra, like everything was a perfect cube with a slanty roof.
Yeah.
So it was like a perfectly like a Rubik's cube level of cube, but then the roof had to have like a cool fade haircut.
Well, we can talk about this ad infinitum, but I'm sure that there are many people who drive around South Africa with the exact attitude that Sia described just now, and you look at shit and you go, oh, that is so ugly. And yes, apartheid architecture was the worst. The SABC building, all of those.
When they put, they put fish tank gravel on the cement on the outside, and that's a finish. Like it's stone.
No,
that is
that.
A like, thing.
And face brick. Yeah. Because, you know, evil's evil, right? And there's no, it's not better if it's got more fashion sense. But I mean, the Nazis looked imposing and they're like, they had an aesthetic.
Well, it's called fascist architecture.
The Afrikaans folk were like, right, everything can be brown. And if you can find a way to combine two or three browns, that's great.
And they loved
the brown on brown and a bit of gray.
Those apartheid oaks loved a little bit of yellow and yellow and orange and yellow stained glass in as many places as possible.
Low maintenance, high impact.
I go into those buildings, honestly, it makes me feel a bit sick.
Yeah, that's the worst.
So I think maybe that was their purpose. Who knew? Anyway, so Gord's just reminded me that we need to do a shout-out, and we don't do this often, but Diane, a.k.a. the Dutch, who is listening to us in Toronto, happy birthday.
Very nice. Happy birthday. The legend.
Very good. And let's get into some headlines, because we have no time to waste. So. All right. The family of Amy Lieder-Jager said on Tuesday that they were relieved that the suspected mastermind behind the kidnapping of the six-year-old and a co-accused intend to plead guilty. Do you remember the story? You remember the story about... There was a little kid who was abducted.
Was this the one in the restaurant?
No. But we're going to talk to the guy who saved the kid in the restaurant just now.
Oh, heavy.
Yeah. He's a hero. He's a proper hero. He's going to be on the show with us just now, so listen out for that. But while we're talking about kidnapped children, there was a story not so long ago. In fact, I think it happened...
Should have been last year sometime.
Yeah, towards the end of last year. Remember, there was a... Amy Lieder-Jager is the little girl's name. She was 6 years old at the time, and she was kidnapped, and they thought it was an extortion attempt. They were going to ask for ransom money. Turned out that they knew who the kidnapper was. Tarina Himan, her lawyer, has said that the client has reached a plea and sentence agreement with the state, which will be confirmed for the next court appearance. Himan is accused of orchestrating the abduction near her school in Vanderbijl Park, which resulted in the girl going missing for 19 hours before she was dropped off next to a road. Her lawyer, David May, said his client reached an agreement with the state. However, her co-accused, Letitia Nell, has now also indicated that she will plead guilty to some of the charges. So things are moving ahead there. You see, we are so, again, we can't wait for 5 minutes for justice to do its work. We have to have everything done now. We demand instant gratification, and I'm afraid that the wheels of justice do not turn that fast. However, Nell did not agree to the agreement that Himan settled with the state in terms of the sentence and will now approach another court in Pretoria. They both said they were remorseful. The majority of the case is very straightforward, and we're looking at a period of direct imprisonment. My client is very remorseful, said the lawyer, for what happened, and I can confirm that. Well, I should hope so, for stealing a child. And as I said, we'll be speaking to the dude who rescued that child at a restaurant just the other day, which I think the video went viral. Everyone was talking about it. And we'll speak to him about like what goes through your head when that happens. I think it's something, it's the right thing to do, and it's something that a lot of people would do, and that's in fact what he has said in his one public statement that I found. But I think this may be the first time that he actually goes on the record and explains what happened. So I'm looking forward to speaking to him in just a short while. In other news from EWN, George Bezos' funeral is to take place at the Greek Orthodox Church in Johannesburg on Thursday at 11. And the funeral service will be followed by a burial at West Park Cemetery. Due to strict COVID-19 protocols, only 50 people will be allowed. However, the service will be broadcast live on SABC and various social media platforms. The late human rights lawyer and activist passed away last week at the age of 92. What a guy, though. What a big contribution he made to South Africa. and someone who lived a very full life. You know, he managed to escape the Nazis as a child. He got on a boat with his dad, and they managed to thwart the Nazis in one of their attempts to subjugate Greece. I mean, it wasn't a battle, but it was a little effort that he and his dad made. And then he came to South Africa and started from scratch. Ended up representing Nelson Mandela at the Rivonia trials. And he did an enormous amount of good in his life, including founding the Sehete School in the east of Johannesburg, which is something of an institution now. So well done, George.
I really am not naive when it comes to history and things, but I still get stunned that this, you know, we have people like this in our midst right now.
Doesn't it make you feel like you're a bit of an underachiever? Because that's what I get. I feel so useless. No, I feel like I've done nothing in my life when I read about these things. I was reading about Mark Antony, you know, the Roman conqueror.
The R&B singer and dancer that married Jennifer Lopez.
No. The Roman general who was Caesar's 2IC and who became...
But could he dance?
I was reading about what he did. And I mean, the things that guy achieved before he'd even turned 40. And here I am. On the
helps
other side.
To have infinite resources and an army of slaves, though. Well, I mean, I'd build some works if I didn't have to do any work. Just had to plan everything.
I feel like a supreme underachiever.
That comparison is a little hectic.
Well, even George Bezos. I mean, like, look at what he'd done.
I rather look at it from the viewpoint of gratitude that they did these great things that they did for us. So that we could have a life. Like, I really...
Sia's basically saying it's not about you, Gareth. No, you're right.
Because I can almost bank on the fact that I would not have been courageous. I really would not have been. You read about everything. I've never read Elie Wiesel's Night yet. I've just, you know, heard extracts and whatnot and seen his interviews. How he explains what people went through in concentration camp. Goodbye. Mm-hmm. One evening of that, I'd say.
Yeah, okay. Victor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, and you get a similar kind of like, how is this person so chilled about all of this?
Yeah.
But I mean, also, you're always going to feel a sense of being dwarfed if you compare yourself to, you know, those people who have done.
Yeah, rewind to the beginning of the show this morning, and we're complaining about waking up.
Yeah. I prefer
but
that.
I'm also saying that if I had an army of concubines and a flute player who woke me up in exactly the right way every morning with a pre-selected song composed for me by James Hetfield, who I keep captive in the dungeon to write my morning songs, I'd also have an easier time of waking up.
All right. In other news, we have from the Eastern Cape, the communities there are begging for help in a water crisis. Nobody seems to be talking about this. We brought it up on the Burning Platform the other day, but the Eastern Cape is struggling with drought. A small town of Kliplaat, which is 120 kilometers from Graaff-Reinet, is feeling neglected. Farmers are calling on the gift of the givers for help as livestock are dying. Many people are jobless. Ria van Sail, who's a farmer there, said that it's very dry. They're struggling with the animals at the moment because there's no food and there's no water for them. You know, you see these horrible images on TV news when they bother to report on these things, when they aren't reporting on shampoo at Clicks. And you see these animals starving to death and then, you know, desiccated, just dying, falling over and dying because they haven't had water for a week. Pumla Siani, who's a nurse, said the poverty here is so bad that people even eat out of the bin. They sleep without food. Now I know that human nature is very resilient because I don't understand how people manage to live here. And then Imtiaz Suleiman from the Gift of the Givers has called on government to please assist in the entire province. Of course, there are parts of PE, suburbs in PE, where they now have to bring in water in trucks. And we're not talking about outlying and poor neighborhoods. We're talking about all the neighborhoods in PE. So there's some serious stuff going on there. And obviously from, you know, the rest of us who seem to be concerned with much more easy to solve things like, you know, lockdown rules and that kind of crap. It just seems that there are people with real problems and we should be aware of that before we complain too much.
And I mean, like my housekeeper is just the loveliest lady, and she lives in one of those areas out past Cosmo City. Mm. And she says, and I've lost count now, but it has to be closer to 2 months because it was one a while ago. They just haven't had electricity, and it's not load shedding related. It's got to do with they're just being told something or other has been stolen, and they may or may not get a new one. And until further notice, there's no electricity for the entire suburb. It's not like a road. It's the whole town. And they haven't had electricity for like 2 months. And what do you do? Like, they contact the government all the time, and they get told, yes, we're aware. Sorry, yeah. We'll let you know.
And then nothing happens.
And I mean, now imagine that's water. I flipped out because I just bought like a whole load shedding, anti-load shedding gadget pack to sort of mitigate it. And thinking to myself, like, wow, they turn the power off every other day for a few hours, and that's my biggest problem.
Well, in other news,
someone else has always got a worse shit show than yours. Like, when the water goes away, that's when you proper fucked.
Yeah. The UK has started to spend some money on tech in orbital awareness, which means that satellites that are going around the Earth are going to be equipped with some much more high tech and I suppose you could say advanced observational equipment. And that's always a good thing. When we spend money on that stuff, we end up helping people in drought-stricken areas as well, because we find out how we can understand the Earth better by paying attention to these facts. So the BBC's reporting this morning that new approaches to tracking satellites and debris in orbit are going to get a boost from the UK Space Agency. They're giving £1 million to 7 firms to help advance novel sensor technologies and the smart algorithms needed to interpret the data that comes from them. Finding better ways to survey objects moving overhead has become a high priority issue. With more and more satellites being launched, there's a growing concern about the potential for collisions. I mean, there's a huge amount of space junk.
Starlink are putting up, I think, 12,000, and they're sending 60 at a time, and they're not slowing down. And but they're at a lower orbit. They're at low Earth orbit, which means they have to travel a lot faster to stay up. But this is a really good reminder, because I almost forgot to bring it up. But 2 days ago, the Royal Astronomical Society, in Britain announced that they've picked up and confirmed the existence of phosphenes in the atmosphere of Venus, which to all of our knowledge is always the result of biological processes. So it's not evidence of life on Venus, but they found confirmed evidence of a process that we only know to be associated with biological activity on Earth, and we don't know any other way that these phosphenes get created. They find them one other place in the solar system, in tiny amounts in Jupiter, and there they're produced much closer to the core, where there's millions of times more pressure. So the only way we know of that these phosphenes can happen is with biological processes like we have on Earth. So they want to send this is like when they found that there was definitely once water on Mars. It's that big news. It doesn't mean there's life. It means there definitely could be. That's and amazing. Now they want to properly explore Venus. And this was the Royal Astronomical Society. There was a live stream. They had people, scientists from all over the world. So it's a real discovery. And they also have literally said, we are dying for people to peer review this to help us find out whether we've found something as big as we think. And that's the glory of the scientific method. It's like, come on, dudes, rip this to pieces, because we got to see whether we're right.
Very interesting. Yeah. Here's another story from the BBC this morning. They found an entire bear in Ice Age ice that's been completely preserved. In other words, there is organic material on this bear. And Gordon and I have laughed before, because we've imagined like dinosaurs with like really cool mod haircuts and things like that.
Yeah.
Because of course you can't.
It could have happened.
No, you can't preserve hair. So dinosaurs might have had really weird hairstyles. Which would be hilarious. But they found an Ice Age bear who's in the, let me just try and pronounce this, the Lyakhovsky Islands in northeast Russia. And
how crazy are the photos?
Jesus, you could see its teeth and nose. They're intact.
But is it an extant species of bears? Or
No, it's a species.
Old, ancient bear.
It's a species of brown bear that existed 22,000 to 39,500 years ago.
Let me guess, it was fuck you size.
It was big. It was big. But what they've managed is it's got the fur is still attached, and it's been preserved so beautifully in this ice. You've got to look at it. It was
they found a dog like that in the tundra as well. It was like a domesticated dog that was somewhere between the wolf phase and the pet phase from like also 20,000-30,000 years ago. And they could like still see what was inside its stomach, and it had like fur and teeth and all that. So they find shit from back in the day, and you realize Like, we got chilled animals now.
Chilled literally in this case, because the bear was revealed by melting permafrost in northeastern Russia. Scientists known for the research into woolly mammoths and other prehistoric species suggested the discovery was unprecedented. It is completely preserved. All the internal organs are in place, even its nose. Previously, only skulls and bones have been found. This is a find.
Well, its nose is not in place if it's among the internal organs.
Well, no, but you must see this thing's teeth. It's got real ice age teeth, you know, like the big choppers that you would only get on those monstrous carnivores that existed at that time. So that's really interesting.
Gord, just for some clarification, what is fuck you size?
Yeah.
Everything back in the day was like big enough to just immediately eat you without having to like prepare you at all. So you think like, yeah, shit, a leopard is like super scary. And like our ancestors used to get like eaten by them when they jumped out of trees. You'd like, the leopard would just land on your head and bite your head off. But I mean, a saber-toothed tiger would do the same to the leopard while it's eating you. So they used to, the megafauna used to be some serious shit. And you remember the prehistoric fuck you bird, the massive
the
thing with the head like a steeple. Uh-huh. And that was just normal because there was so much oxygen in the air back in the day, and like being bigger gave you an advantage, and there were massive trees and massive shit. And then if you were a predator, there were massive things to eat. But like even still, human beings did away with a lot of those serious predator threats. And it's sad now that species have gone extinct. But if you look at it not as in terms of industrialization and just a species trying to survive against another one, we were easy to kill. I mean, we were an easy snack for a long time.
Yeah.
We were literally the chicken nuggets of the savannah for so long. And then we got this revenge pluck, like, fuck you guys, we're coming back. And it's now become a part of us. We need to go, okay, guys, we got back at the animals.
Now we must stop.
It's equal now.
But that's such a great description. We were the nuggets of the of the Cretaceous. Yeah,
at bad events and at like office meetings, those platters which have like freezing cold meatballs and freezing cold sausages and freezing cold pastries, and it's just sadness that you have like wax flavored sadness. Like we were that. I think a lot of animals probably didn't eat us. Mom, not another human. Can't we go get a stegolodon? You had one last week, son. We're having humans and you'll like it.
Gord, you just made me realize something. We should not be complaining in the year 2020 when all we fear is just, oh, we need to lock up our homes and our doors.
You've got water and food and you didn't have to fish and or hunt either. You're good.
Humans way back when used to leave the house and used to actually fear being eaten.
Listen, here are some notes. This is from, let me just see. We got here from Kala. He says, morning, Gord. Welcome back. Happy the books are still happening. My kids loved the people who forgot to be nice. P.S.
Oh, thank you, friend.
P.S. How is Hi Rob? Are you guys still in contact?
Yeah, actually. Hi Rob is, he's got his motorbike and he's got his license and he's riding it like constantly. He's still offensively handsome. Both him and our Ken Bobinski have been working out quite consistently during
the time. Do you see what Ben posted?
Yeah, you know how much fun it is being in a Let's Achieve Our Goals group with Rob and Ben, and one of the goals is be more handsome. That's like being in a running group with Usain Bolt and Bruce Fordyce. I mean, I think the Bruce Fordyce aspect of that would be as much of a jaw as Hi Rob is. But yeah, he's enviably handsome. He's riding his motorbike. He's living his best life. He's not died of the Roro just yet. Hi Rob's good. In fact, Hi Rob, since he's almost certainly listening, because he really is a dedicated listener, I just think there's nothing good to listen to on the radio in Holland. Hi Rob, why don't you hit us up with an update, mate?
Do you know what?
We can't disclose the sacred texts that we share with each other.
Yeah, it would be good to connect with him. Let's do that, Sia.
Cool. So talking about Ben, do you know what makes Ben impressive in my mind? That is like he just takes everything as, just nothing major at all. When he posted the other day about like his fitness journey and over the past couple of months and we've been scoffing down chocolates, he was like, yeah, well, this is what I've just been trying. You know, I'm not a professional, but, you know, don't, you know, listen to me, don't listen to me. This is what I just have to say. I'm like, Ben, damn it. You're impressive.
No, Ben is he gets shit done. You know, what I like about Ben, he puts his mind to something and he just quietly goes about doing it. He doesn't tell everybody what he's going to do until it's done.
Mm. Yeah, good old Ken Bobinski. I miss him.
All right. Well, shame, Gord. You can always pick up your phone.
I do.
Then this message comes through from Ruth. She says, what is your best type of architecture? I love Gothic and medieval style, dark wood, deep burgundy, classic antiques.
You busted that out like you were reading it. You have that answer prepared in case someone asks you, don't you?
No, there's a range of stuff. I mean, I don't have all the same period of stuff in my own house. And I hate the exterior architecture of my house because it's modern. I'd love to build a house out of stone.
I live in a Norwegian townhouse hybrid of Game Reserve and Tuscany. So yeah, you must know how.
Norwegian is the only way to describe it.
I don't know what the Gothic style specifically means, but I do know
Gothic style is those cathedrals you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, but I know that I resent Barcelona, but it's a super beautiful place. The Gothic quarter there has got some of the most beautiful buildings ever. Are those Gothic buildings?
Yes.
Gothico, the Gothic, yeah.
If you're talking about, there was an attempt to revive the Gothic. They called it Gothic Revival in the early 1900s. So towards the end of the Victorian era, and places like the Houses of Parliament in London are based on a Gothic revival. There was an architect called Pugin who was instrumental in all of that. He was very into, he even designed furniture that looked Gothic. You know, it's got sort of those pointy, it's very much vertical in its construction. Anyway, so there's lots. I'm not actually into the Gothic so much. I think it's a bit churchy for me, but there we go. Sia, you should still fear being eaten because you are small. And there is a killer waiting for you. Don't think just because the saber-toothed tigers have gone that you are safe.
Thanks for that.
There's the bloodthirsty serial killers who like to wear fair, soft, supple, beautiful, bronze glowing skin on their faces.
There we go.
Come on, God.
Andrew Gavea says...
If I was a skin hunter, I'm just putting it out.
Quarry.
If I was going to make a face outfit of someone else's skin, you'd be 1, 2, and 3 on my list.
Not creepy at all.
Yeah.
Andrew says, hey, Gareth, I'm an architect. I think we've opened up a can of worms here. And I'm completely fascinated with cathedrals and churches around the world. What saddens me is, as you mentioned, nowadays people want instant gratification to the point where we've lost the ability to give attention to detail, which is where the beauty lies. Architects aren't seen as masters of the arts anymore. They're expected to design a shell as quickly as possible. Oh, man, this is... You see, Andrew, what you're doing is you're actually convincing me that it was a good idea not to become an architect. Because if you told me to build a parking lot, I'd be so heartbroken.
I'd be good at that. I'd have great ideas for parking lots. How about put exit signs where they can be seen from any vantage point, you assholes?
All right, calm down, Gord. When visiting buildings designed by Gaudi, for example, all I could think was the amount of work and passion that he put into the small details, like designing the door handles. The shell of the building was just a small part of architecture back then. It was really about having the passion and patience and creating beauty which would last forever. Spot on.
Yeah, like the Dali Museum in Spain. It's like Dali designed his own museum, and the museum itself is like a multifaceted artwork with all kinds of stuff and hidden Easter eggs and, you know, a little telescope that if you find and look through, it shows you a tiny piece of another painting where there's something hidden. You know, the garden has got the car that's raining inside. It's in some ways, it's not necessarily aging all that well. But, I mean, it's an incredible concept. Like, the actual building is the artwork in which the artwork is housed. It's amazing.
I've been designing buildings on, first of all, on paper with pencils when I was much younger, and since then on my laptop since I was probably about 12. I can pull out like scrolls from one of these cupboards where I've been drawing buildings for the longest time, like long before I was doing anything else that was conceivably useful. And I know that these things are just fantasies because they'll never be built. But, man, it gives me such joy to go back. And you can see how many times I've rubbed things out with an eraser and then started again and changed this and changed that. And it just gives me such happiness. I can't tell you how excited I get about doing things like that.
I felt the same way drawing ninjas and comical chickens.
Sure. Everybody has their thing. You know, you've got to have some creative outlet. And, you know, everybody calls themselves creative these days. Like, I wouldn't even call myself creative because a lot of the stuff I do is just stuff I enjoy doing or it's stuff that I have to do. But if you're really into something, like Gord is about writing these kids' books, for example, I mean, that's like, you've got to chase that, man, because...
And Jackie Chan. Yep. Super into Jackie Chan.
All right, someone's saying here, can we move right along? This is getting boring. So, Chris, okay, we'll move on.
Which part, though? The architecture stuff specifically?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, we're done with architecture, but it was a good topic. We covered it thoroughly, I think.
What is this thing, Sia? Coachella is something we all know. It's that festival they have in the desert where a whole lot of people take drugs and have sex and walk around basically naked, and it's really mostly rich and very good-looking people. But what is Auntchella? What is this?
Auntchella is... Gladys Knight and Patti LaBelle singing together over the weekend that was. If you just are into old school music, or as well, if you just want to reminisce about the good old days and see these women in their 70s have a good old time, please just watch it. They did a live stream versus battle. Mm-hmm. So it would be one battle. Singing a hit song. Yeah.
Imagine a battle between Gladys Knight and Patti LaBelle. I love this.
No, they were not wearing armor and
no, but
they weren't like freestyling insults off the top of their heads.
But a singing battle between those two would be worth watching.
Yeah, where one person has to like do a little melody and some notes and the other person has to like match it and then add something.
Yeah.
So they were singing their hit songs and then in between all of that, they were, you know, it's just like the storytelling as well. Them talking about their heydays in music. It's just so, so cool. So yeah, I watched that. It aired on Sunday evening, US time. So I watched it on Monday and it's just so cool. Dionne Warwick she made a cameo as well. She came in and just old school good music. If you want to just feel good about music right now, that's the way to
What's it called again, just so we can make sure we can find it? Auntchella.
That's like the name social media gave it. Just Google Gladys Knight and Patti LaBelle. It was a live stream, so now it's available all over the place. And by the way, even more good work done with the two of them.
Yeah, I love that. I would watch that. I think it's amazing. That's so cool. Sure. I love when these old school singers, I told you when I went to go and I was probably the only person under the age of, at that stage, 35, who went to a Dionne Warwick concert, but she was great. Everyone, I mean, there were people there in walkers and Zimmer frames and electric wheelchairs. And I had a pretty good seat and this woman, she changed her outfit every two songs. She came out in some like ball gown, and she's in her 70s or 80s now at least, right? I mean, she was putting on the best show she could put on, just like a proper, you know, those old school singers knew what it was to be a showman.
Oh yeah,
they knew. Yeah. Show
I mean, I, my first ever proper concert, I was 12 years old, and I was at Sun City, and my parents got Bryan Adams was playing there, and my parents took me with for the weekend, and I mean, that was like heaven for me. Sun City. Sometimes you got to take a friend, other times not, but you'd get like $50, and you could spend a whole day in that amazing games arcade and stuff. But they gave me tickets for Bryan Adams, and obviously I'd heard Bryan Adams, and I was like, I rocked out. I mean, I'm no Bryan Adams fan, but it was an amazing experience, and there's to this day, I still don't know how they did the thing where he was like, ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you in a few moments. Yeah.
You know what I love then, is you just said, then you said almost was, hold on, you said it was like heaven for you, and I just thought of his song.
Oh, thinking about those younger years.
Yes. I was at the continent.
Yes.
No, I think of the version that's interspersed with
oh, yeah.
Baby, no, we don't talk about that version. and probably sung by an East European who doesn't know what the words mean, and you can tell because the, and that song gets played every 12 minutes at the gym. But I still to this day don't know, and now I don't want to know because the mysticism must live on. How he was like, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be, and immediately there was a stage at the other side behind everybody, so the people at the back could be up front for two songs, and then he was back again, and I'm like, Bryan Adams can teleport, and I've never questioned it. That's like amazing. It blew my mind. So yeah, you were saying those concerts you went to when you were young.
Yeah. Yeah.
They stick with you so much, even if it's music you don't even like.
Like Dion Warwick wasn't when I was young, but I remember the first concert. I think I might have seen Mango Groove with my parents when I was a teenager, and you know, nothing was cool enough. And I remember seeing them and thought, Jesus, those guys are cool.
Yeah.
Dare I say, I think my first concert was Enrique Iglesias.
Oh, that's perfect. I'm so glad it was Enrique for you. What? That's perfect.
It was like that weird tennis park venue in Durban, and that was just the thing. I remember that was like the biggest thing that year, Enrique coming to Durban. Yeah, I think that was it.
That was when artists still used to go to Durban because people in Durban might have actually supported arts.
Yeah, now no. It's always Cape Town and Joburg.
And then Durban has the cheek to complain, but none of them ever pitch when someone puts on a show.
They don't go. No. I mean, like the Durban Metallica concert in 2006 was like the first time they had an undersold venue, because there's like sellout is when the standing room is sold, and then mm-hmm. there's additional seats. So you don't have to fill the stadium to technically sell out. It was like the first time they hadn't sold out since 88 or something like that.
They were,
and by that we mean not sold enough tickets to make the thing a success.
I think they were a bit
pissed off. And Cape Town and Joburg were packed.
Yeah, but that's Durban. Typical of Durban. Durban lets us down, I'm afraid, when it comes to that stuff. Mm,
Yeah, I was heavily involved in SA music, and the young Durban scene always complain that that bands go everywhere except there, but then they either don't go watch the bands, or they're so insular in their little rock community that they go so they can cross their arms and scowl and go, it's not as good as our band.
Mm. Hey, Gord, do you remember some chick being pulled off the stage at that Bryan Adams concert during the DJ's performance?
Jeez, no. I mean, I was 12, but I remember being blown away. I don't remember someone.
No, someone saying that was them.
Yeah. Oh, that was you?
No, it's not me.
You went for Bryan. You saw Bryan and just everything told you, go have that.
All right. Well, what do we got? We've got this awesome dude. I'm so excited about this. It's already just past 7, so we've got a break for the podcast. But Dishel Suku is the restaurant owner who... He's the guy you've seen, even if you don't know his name. He thwarted an alleged kidnapping at an eatery in Johannesburg. Well, it wasn't alleged. It was an attempted kidnapping in Johannesburg last week. And there's video of this brave act being circulated and shared thousands of times on social media. And I just thought it would be really cool to speak to the dude. And I know he's not really looking for attention. He's quite publicity shy. But he's agreed to talk to us this morning. So hang around for that, because that'll be loads of fun. Speak to him and ask him about what was going through his head and figure out what kinds of things kick into overdrive in a situation like that. Because you can see in the video, he just kind of, I don't know, he must have flown over those tables and he just grabs this dude and he like gets him into a throttle and he saves the child eventually. So that was just a very cool thing to see. And I know a lot of people saying, oh, well, you know, anyone in that situation would do that to save a child. I think you're probably right, but... This guy actually did. So it's not a would have, could have, maybe should have situation. It's a did happen. So I'm keen to talk to him. That's coming up. Here's your song, Gord.
Listen. Oh, nice.
Yeah. It's Bryan Adams' Heaven, just for you.
No, exactly what I wanted.
I know you love it.
CliffCentral.com.